recording, huh? So we are on lesson 6, chapters 18 through 21. Trying to see. I'm counting for a reason. I keep counting. I know. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, 12, 13, 14, 15, 16, 17, 18, 19, 20, 21, 22. Okay. All right. So we have been talking about, for 2 weeks, the battles of words. We're actually now going beyond the battles of words to other things. So this whole lesson is called Settled into Security. So now that the battles are done, Joshua and Israel are supposed to be looking into, so what does it look like to start settling into this land, into this possession? What does it look like to start living what we've battled for and what God has battled for us and given to us? What is that going to look like? So what we should have noticed, and perhaps we didn't notice, we noticed that all of a sudden they're in a different place. They're in Shiloh. Does anyone know where they've been coming from the whole time? From Joshua 1 on? Gilgal. So that Gilgal has been their base camp. But now they're moving from Gilgal to Shiloh. And so we're going to see this shift of movement. All the battles came from the base at Gilgal. It keeps saying, if you go through Joshua, you'll see them going back to Gilgal. And from Gilgal, Joshua led the army to battle this battle. And Joshua led the army. So all of our stones have been either in Gilgal or from Gilgal. Remembering that, anybody remember what Gilgal means? What? Say that again, Kristen.
Is it roll away?
Yeah, roll away the reproach, right? And what it meant is rolled away the reproach of Egypt. The first thing they did in Gilgal was to set up the 12 memorial stones, which are over here. They were to set up the 12 memorial stones to remember that it was God who stopped the waters of death coming. It was God who opened up the waters so that they could get there. It was God who crossed them over. Remember that it's God who's done this. And then they have him circumcised because it's God having rolled away the reproach of Egypt. In other words, God is saying, I am the one who has taken away the paradigm of transactional living. I'm the one who's done that. Understand that I've done that for you. Not because you wanted me to, not because you did something great and so now I can do it, but I've done that. In the midst of all your grumbling and complaining and being in slavery, I've taken that paradigm away from you. I've rolled away the reproach. I've rolled away that separation that you have globbed onto. I've rolled that away. And in that, he wants them to see that each of the battles comes out of that. So in rolling away the approach, God went first, right? And so we'll twist our little saying that we've said, here I am, here you are, here we are together. What if it's God saying that to them? God says, here I am. I have rolled away the reproach. And here you are. You have joined me in rolling away the reproach because you've received the circumcision. You've received me taking away the transactional living paradigm. You've received that. Now, here we are together. Let's go out and incarnate that. Let's go out and live that rolling away the reproach. Therefore, all the battles are an incarnation of rolling away the reproach. Does that make sense to you?
Yes.
Okay. Well, it makes sense to Jen. How about anybody else? does anybody understand where we're going with that?
Jeez, I didn't know it was going to be that long.
Yes. Yes, no, or is that confusing?
A little confusing.
A little confusing? Okay. So God has already taken away the fact that they are a transactional being, right?
Yeah.
He's already done that.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. In the circumcision, he said, join me in that.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Allow me to take the cover off. And so when they submit to circumcision, they're allowing him, right? So it's, here I am, God says, here you are. Okay, now we're here. Now together, let's actually walk through that. let's walk through taking that covering off. So we did it symbolically with circumcision. Now we're going to go out into the field, and we're going to actually live that. We're going to incarnate. We're going to put some flesh to that. We're going to go into battles and take down the walls of Independence and Jericho. We're going to go to AI, and we're going to take down the walls of self-satisfying ways. We're going to go into the tent of Achan and take away the hidden spoils. We're actually physically going to walk through what it's like to take the reproach away, to take that paradigm away. Does that make sense now? Mm-hmm. Yes? Yeah. Okay. So, here I am, God says. Here you are. Here we are together. Okay, we're going to do this together. We're going to flesh it out. So when God does something, he always wants us to flesh it out as well so that we experience it, right? It's one thing to say, oh, yes, I do this, but if you don't experience it in your body, which is how he's made us, then it never becomes a part of you, right?
I have a little thought
to
add to that picture. I was thinking of a friend of mine. They just went through their son having cancer, okay? And so they got used to this kind of battle mode, essentially, with cancer, right? They were battling this, they were battling that, and that became kind of like their relationship with her husband was growing because they were in this battle mode. And then when he was cancer-free, they suddenly were like, oh, how do we live now? How do we do life now?
Right.
Like, we have to kind of figure out how to do life together outside of battle and craziness.
Yep.
And I think that's what's going on. They were in Gilgal, they were in this craziness, and they had a relationship with God that worked in crisis, but now we're out of battles.
Right.
And how do we do life now? And
right.
I think that's what's going on.
Yeah, that's exactly. So we need to understand then that they were walking through the battles, that they were walking through the reproach being taken away. We do that as well. He brings us those experiences for purposes. So we need to kind of review that. If the fact is that we incarnated, is that hard to use that word, incarnated? We put flesh on. We walked through real life experiences of God bringing us to the battles of independence, of hidden spoils, of self-satisfying ways, of our words of death, trying to get life for ourselves. We've walked through those battles with God. But those battles weren't what rolled away the reproach. They were experiencing God rolling away the reproach. Does this make sense? This is where we get confused. Oftentimes we think, well, we have to do it in order to get it. No, God says, I'm giving it to you. Now do it so you experience it. That's what's happening with the battles. So let's talk about those battles and whether we're experiencing them. Because I think what often happens for me, because I do talk abstractly, that's just how I talk all the time, right? And you can walk away with these great abstractions and yet never experience it. That's your responsibility. I can't make you experience that. I try. I try to pull you to field trips and I try to have you do these things, but I can't make you experience it. So I'm going to ask you if you've experienced these, and then we're going to talk about the actual experiences. When we join God in the battles against our independence, there's always going to be loss. Always. Battles are always going to bring loss. We are always going to experience loss in those battles. What do we lose in our battles against independence? Well, basically, we lose the ability to say what we want, when we want it, how we want it. Mm-hmm. Basically, we lose control, right? Whenever God brings me a battle that's against my independence, a battle against my self-satisfying ways, I'm losing something. I'm losing control. But there are specific things I'm losing. I'm going to give you examples, and then I want you to think about your own examples. Because often those losses are shattering, almost always. Because it's a way I lived, like she said with her family with the little boy with cancer, this is how we've lived. And now we're not living that way, so I've lost a way that I know how to deal, right? Mm-hmm. How do I deal with it? I don't know. And often that loss feels so shattering. It's like all we're left is with rubble now. You've just destroyed a way we lived. Now I don't know what to do. And the funny thing is, this is exactly how everybody was responding when I talked about my sprinkler incident. You know, calling up the sprinkler guy and not doing what I did. And many of you said, well, how are we supposed to do it then? How are we supposed to live life? As if there were no other way. right? We only know this way. So when God says, let's battle that, we're going to take that way away of living, we're all like, well, how do I do life then? Mm-hmm. I don't know how to do life any other way. So there's a loss. And really, it's important that we look at that loss. What is the loss? Mourn that loss, because it is a loss. Because without mourning, we can't move on. Mm-hmm. Otherwise, we just hold on to it, right?
Yep.
We hold on to it and say, well, then how do I do life? If I can't talk to the sprinkler guy and say, look, guy, this is what I'm paying you for. If I can't do that, how else am I going to get my sprinkling system turned off? Right? Same situations with all these little things and big things. We have a way of living, and when God destroys them, we're lost. We feel like we're in this crumble of rubble. What am I going to do here? What is the rubble then in your life? And I want you specifically to think, I really want you to share this time. I want you to talk so much that you shut me up. I want to know what... I am, but it's going to be... It'll take a lot, right? What is the rubble then? I'm going to ask you all those situations when God actually comes against our walls of independence. I'll share mine, and then I want you to think about what specifically the rubble is for you. For me, when God brings some independence down, it's always the rubble is not being able to have an uncomplicated life, not being able to plan without just me in mind. I lose the avoidance of messy life. That's what I lose. The inability to have messy life, the ability to not have a messy life. That's what I lose. What do you lose when God brings down some independent wall of yours, some wall that says, you know, it's about me getting what I need, so I will go ahead and do it? Can you think of things?
Yeah, but I have a hard time putting it in terms of the rubble.
Okay. So talk about a battle against independence.
Jill, can you explain yours again?
When God brings...
Be specific.
Carolyn, can you share it for Jill?
That would be good.
She knows
me well enough to know some of those things. Sometimes I get tired of sharing some of the same stories, so you just think, really? I'm gonna go down one just to share a story that is a little bit easier to look at. Not easier for me, just easier to explain. One of the battles also, the second battle would be exposing my coverings, right? My hidden spoils. So one of my I have lots of coverings. But my biggest covering is that I want to look perfect. I'm a perfectionist. I want to look good because I feel that's the only way that I'll be valuable to anybody. That's how I was brought up. I'm not valuable because I'm lovable. I'm valuable because of what I do. So I like to look perfect. Therefore, so God brings into my life all sorts of disasters. My husband's incident, having Bible study over here. And he goes, yeah, you don't have time to study and clean the house and make sure it looks great and it's decorated perfect. Like, so you can't do that anymore. So what are you going to do with the rubble of not looking perfect? So when my husband went to the hospital, my son told me, Mom, do you realize that throughout my whole life, all my friends have said, you guys have the perfect family? Mm-hmm. And that did two things to me. The first was, oh, yay, that's exactly what I was trying to achieve. Literally. And within the same thought, it was like, oh, you're kidding me. But I knew it. I already knew that. And so I was always buoying that up, right? When that happened, and everyone knew, whether I wanted them to or not, that we don't have a perfect family, all of a sudden it was like, so what are you going to do with that rubble? Now you can actually be real with people. Now, not only can you be real with people and share all of this, they can be real with you. The rubble actually turned out to be great, right? Does that make sense? Yes? Okay. All right, so independent walls. Because for me, that situation just incorporates all of it, and that's why I go to that. Independent walls. I don't like a messy life, which really talks to my perfectionism, doesn't it? Which really talks to me wanting value out of what people see rather than value of just being me. So I lose that. I lose that ability to be valued, to not have a messy life, because not having a messy life, having a life that doesn't look messy to me, I think, well, then people will value me, which is kind of a ridiculous thought, but it's there. It's definitely there. I don't think, literally, so one of our field trips, we had a conversation about would you rather be popular or smart? And right away, what do you think I said?
Smart.
Smart. Smart. And two in the group said, you know, everybody says smart, and we just want to be popular. We want people to like us. And I thought for weeks on that. I do want people to like me, but I don't think they can like me, so I would rather be smart because they'll like me for my smartness. That's where I went. That's what's going on here. Losing the ability to have this really pretty picture so that people will value me. I lose that ability when God brings me situations that tear down my walls of independence, of exposing my covers. Does this make sense?
Yep.
Okay, so now, can you share?
Yep.
Okay.
So, my whole life, I have needed other people to validate me. Because when I was growing up, I'm the oldest child. I'm very type A, very much perfectionist. We have a lot of the same problem. And so my parents just assumed I was good and dealt with everybody else. And I didn't get my needs met. So I have always been a person that needs to be able to have the independence to go to whomever I need at any time to get my buckets filled. Okay, so if I'm sitting at home and I'm feeling lonely, I need to be able to go over to Kim and say, Kim, let's go eat brunch. If I'm feeling like I need to be, like that I deserve something and I'm not getting it, I need to go to the mall and buy whatever I want. Okay, well, now you can see how this might get in the way of marriage. So in my life, when marriage started to get difficult, instead of submitting and being vulnerable with my partner and leaning into my marriage, what I chose was to populate my life with as many people as I could that could fill my needs whenever I wanted. And I allowed myself to let all kinds in just to get what I needed.
Those are walls of independence for sure.
Yes.
Yeah,
that's a great totally picture. Walls of independence. And and as much as it upset my husband and as much as it pained him, I didn't care because I'm a grown person. I can do this. This is what I need. Mm-hmm. This is when I need it. Well, oh God, you're so great. So God has brought me a lot of people in my life by going through this way of independence that have brought me down and hurt me and has forced me to let go and cut ties and form boundaries around my family of four and turn in. And I had, my rubble is, for me, is I had to become fully vulnerable and fully dependent on my spouse. And that is something I have battled my whole life. So my rubble is that is, to me, and I visualize it, all these people that turned, well, they didn't turn, they were who they always were. I'm trying to get what I need from them. And I have now I used to be very social, I used to be out every weekend, I used to have things going on 2-3 nights a week. And now what I have is I have a very quiet life. I have my good work. I come home and I have my family. And at first it was, I grieved it. I grieved it, I turned away, it must be something wrong with me, there must be something wrong with me. But the gift that I receive is all of this time, through all this crap, I'm trying to get the validation from my spouse. And now I have it in spades, like it's everywhere. Like I even had made a Facebook status yesterday, I'm trying to do the everyday thankful for Thanksgiving, and I had said that I have this wonderful partner who is funny and compassionate and with me every day through this thing called life. And I tagged him, couldn't even think about it, and I immediately got a phone call and said, you have no idea how much that made my day. That is one of the best possible compliments you could have given me, and I'm so glad that we do this thing together. And it was like, wow, such a thoughtless thing that I just did. So for me, my independence has really been what's gotten in the way of me really getting what it is that I need.
Yes.
So
that was perfect. That was a great story. Mm-hmm. That happens in every one of our lives. It's really hard for me to have all these wonderful things that God brings, but us not incarnate it. Us not think through these places that we have. We all have these walls of independence that God brings certain issues into our life so that we get those walls down, because we're not getting life that way. We are trying hard to get life that way with our independence, but we're not. We're trying hard to get life through our coverings, but we're not. We're trying hard to have self-satisfying ways. She actually mentioned most of the things, those four battles, you know, self-satisfying ways of eating, or, you know, whatever it is, spending, in order, because I deserve it, because I want to feel good, and I've determined what's the best way for me to feel good, right? And, of course, with the Halloween candy, that's all I've struggled with every day. It's like, are you kidding me? Well, this is how ridiculous it is. I know that it's a gift to be able to have a piece of candy, but I can't take it as a gift. I have to take it as, I really want this. Well, somebody made me feel bad today. I really deserve to have six little candy bars. Well, I'll hide them so I don't do that. Okay, think about that. I will hide them so I don't do that. So sure, I hide them. Well, who am I hiding them from? Not me. I know where they are. So I manipulate the situations to make me think that I'm not self-satisfying myself, and I am. Of course I'm self-satisfying. I just don't want to deal with the fact that I'm self-satisfying. And God says, really? I want to give you gifts. I want to actually give you the gift of sugar. Sugar is one of his gifts. You know, we've made it into an evil, and therefore now we have to struggle with it. He wants to give us the gift of sugar, but you won't let him. You're making sure, you're kind of planning it for him. But let go of that and discover the rubble actually being something that he can use. Or destroying my death words. Now, hopefully you have something about this. I think the words is a little bit easier for all of us. When God says, a couple weeks ago we talked about, what are your harem words? What are the words that you should not be using? In the last 2 weeks, have you done that? Have you thought through that? Have you not used? Have you said, I cannot use the word idiot anymore, in my head or out loud? So what did I lose by that? I felt like I lost a way to, this is actually what I wrote, I lost a way to be right. I lost a way to battle in my head and say, you are an idiot because you didn't do what I think you should have done. So I lost a way to be right. That's what I lost, right? Mm-hmm. So I want to hear from somebody else. Have you done that? Have you taken your harem words and actually not used them and then felt a loss? Or did you just think that was a really interesting, cool idea and then walk away with still living with death words? Which is what I'm assuming, since nobody says anything.
Mine wasn't one specific word, mm-hmm. but it was specifically talking about my one specific friend in
okay.
a very negative way.
Okay.
My other friend.
Uh-huh.
That seems to be like the easy thing to talk about with this girlfriend of mine, you know, and like we both like bring each other down in it. And so there were times that I felt like I didn't have anything to say.
Uh-huh.
You know?
Yeah.
Which was very convicting and sad to me, you know.
Yes.
But I talked to my girlfriend about it, and I was like, we cannot do this anymore, you know, like we're like making it so much worse.
Yes,
other,
of course,
you know?
Of course. Yes.
So anyways.
So
it wasn't one word, it was just like,
yes.
I don't know, the person, or you know what I'm saying?
Yeah. Yeah, and so you lost what you think you lost a way to connect, right?
Yeah.
And yet, when we think about that, what does it open up room for?
Like positive connection.
Yes. Connection, yeah, connection with life. Expense. Yes, exactly. Yeah. Exactly. Anybody else have any experience with their harem words? Did anybody else do this?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
My harem words are pointing out everyone else's harem words. Just being honest. Especially those that live in my house.
Yes, 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 yes.
Yeah. It's really easy for me to apply these lessons to
other people. Yes. So what did you lose in not being able to do that?
I think it's similar, the being right.
Mm-hmm.
You know?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Anybody else?
I did it and failed because I would get to a point where I just had like no self control and I just.
What was your word?
It was more just a tone than a word.
Mm.
It was more a tone
mm-hmm.
than the actual words. And it's the way I talked to Mike.
Okay.
And in fact, I used that tone this morning.
Mm.
And I get to a point, like, I'll ride along and I'll be doing fine and I'll be patient and I'll just, I'm going to hold back regardless of the tone he's using with me. I'm not going to use a tone. And then the tone comes out.
Mm-hmm. So what are you afraid of if you don't use that tone?
I mean, I verbalized it this morning. I'm like, I don't want you to talk to me that way.
So you're afraid that you won't get to defend yourself.
I didn't like the way that I felt. I
mm-hmm.
felt belittled and mm-hmm. not valued and
yeah.
Yeah.
And you wanted to be able to defend yourself on that. Yeah. I should
yeah,
feel
I
valued.
Guess,
yeah.
I mean, I guess it's defending myself.
Yeah.
I don't know if it's defending myself or I just wanted more respect.
Yeah.
Well, it's independence because what you're doing is you're assuming that your words are going to change his
right.
behavior.
Right.
And they're has it worked so far?
And Jen yeah. makes a point. Every one of these battles, whether it's mm-hmm. words, whether it's self-satisfying mm-hmm. ways, whether it's hidden spoils, is really all about independence, which is why we start with Jericho
yes.
and then go down. And he kind of pulls it apart for us. Well, here, look at your self-satisfying ways. Here, look at your hidden spoils, the way you try to get life for yourself. Here, look at your words. All of those are about independence. All of those are about saying, I know what's best for me. I want what I want, when I want it, how I want it. And the battles always bring us to the rubble of, I don't have control. I don't get to say what is good. I don't get to choose what is right and what is not right for my life. We have, and that feels like a loss, right? Because
mm-hmm.
it's how we live. It's not only how we live, it's how we make sure everybody else lives too. This is a whole society, not just here, but most everywhere, a society of we live in order to have what we want, in order to have a life that we think is right and good when we want it, how we want it, right? Which is why we're just, well, what do you mean I can't do that? Well, then how do I live life? So all of us come up against these pieces of rubble. So is there anybody here who doesn't either get the concept and or doesn't feel like it applies to their life, that God actually brings us battles and that there's rubble from those, that you lose something? Everybody feels like they kind of know that in their life? Yes? Okay. Because if you don't, yes.
Okay, so I'm struggling with how this applies to my life. We in both of our extended families, my husband and I, we have been dealing with really difficult people, and they probably say the same about us. Okay, I'm really aware of that. But I related to what you said about like being in battle mode,
mm-hmm.
because I feel like for 18 years we have been in battle mode
mm-hmm.
with like thinking of this popular book about boundaries and. You know, I just read this other great, in our mind, great book about, you know, what the Bible says about the fool. So I have these words of the foolish.
Mm.
and I gotta protect my children from people that aren't healthy. So it's like this, I want to be a really wise mom and protect these little ones from people that I have decided I don't think are very healthy. And so we can, in one sense, we have these natural boundaries because we're distant proximity-wise from family.
Mm-hmm.
But God does continually convict me that I can't put up a permanent boundary. You know, so I do have like a self-protection, like a safety boundary.
Mm-hmm.
But I still feel like I'm in battle mode, and I constantly try to, there's like this kind of naive side of me that will throw out a little hook, like, okay, can we try to be in relationship with, you know, and there's sometimes when it'll work, and then it'll, something will kind of meet my expectation of destruction, and I'm like, see?
Mm-hmm.
This is why I have to have this boundary of safety, because this is not good.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so I'm still in battle mode. I guess I feel a little bit more peace about the relationships, because as my older girls as they've grown, I see that they're wise. You know, I feel like they get it a little bit, so I don't have to be quite so on the defense or on the offense, you know, like, oh, does
this
make any sense?
Yep.
I think, I mean, you know, I mean, I know we, a lot of us know that whole scripture about our battle not being against flesh and blood.
Mm-hmm.
But I think sometimes, you know, when I read those books too, like, you do almost get into battle mode against a person, right? You're like, that person, and I have those people. My family is bad for us. This is bad, this is good. And I think what's going on in Joshua is he wants to make sure that the Israelites remember, like, hey, what's bad is not, like, those people. What's bad is a way of doing life. So, you know, so what's, I think the challenge is, what's bad in the family? Is it, it's not really the person. Is it this independence? Is it being right? Is it, do you know what I mean?
Yeah, it's like what Robin said. It's like their Haran words.
Yeah.
It's like I have one of the members, like when you said, God wants to give us the gift of sugar. I can't wait to go home and tell my husband this quote, because literally, you cannot believe the 18-year battle over the idea of sugar. I mean, like, it literally has brought such death. I think it will physically kill my mom for how this family member has affected those children. It's crazy.
But I think sometimes, like, talking to that person about, like, hey, I'm not against you, but I do think we have this battle of, and then calling it what it is. Do you know what I mean? Like, of, we're both independent, or we're both wanting to be right. You know what I mean? I don't know. I think what Joshua's getting at is, your enemy isn't a person. Your enemy is a way of life. And so if you're going to be in a battle that God brings you to, which obviously in family, you're always brought to that battle, right?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, there's no way out.
Yeah.
You have to address what the real battle is, I think.
Yes.
I don't know.
Absolutely agree.
This isn't the battle that you are putting your hook up to somebody in hopes, in an independent hope, that they are going to be your way, okay?
Mm-hmm.
So they put that hook out there, and you say, oh, I'm going to see if today we can get together without having this battle of,
mm-hmm.
yeah, sure,
mm-hmm.
okay?
Mm-hmm.
And then what happens is they are who they are. So you are trying to act, and I'm not saying you personally, but like I notice this in my own life, like I'm being the judge.
Right.
That's not my job. I'm forgetting that there's somebody else here with me that I am shushing, which is God, okay? You don't agree with the way these people are living their lives, and that is okay. That is absolutely okay, and you have a right to live your own.
I'm such a little people pleaser.
Mm.
In both instances, the issues are so different, but so specific. And I know what this one, I know the way she wants to live, and so I have tried for years to please her.
Mm-hmm.
When we're together, I do everything her way. I try to be completely agreeable. I don't ever go to battle with her. But I feel like in doing that, I have, we have created a monster. I mean, it's like an out of control beast.
And you probably did that thinking, if I do this, if I avoid this conflict with her, maybe by being with her, then that will bring about change. Oh no. You have to accept her for where she is. Acceptance is the way we deal, because if we're not accepting of someone else, we're not being a parson, we're not being a priest, we're being a preacher. Mm-hmm. And that is where I think it's difficult in everyday life to be in the witness, because if you're in the witness, what you're saying is, yeah, what that person's doing is not okay, but that's for God to judge. I'm going to accept them where they are. I'm going to completely accept them where they are and let God handle the rest. So it's almost like, it reminds me of in Joshua where he's telling us to be silent. And be with it, okay? You've used your words, you've been using your actions, you've been using your words, they're not getting you anywhere. Just settle, quiet, be with, and see what happens. Kind of like with Kim and Mike. If Kim doesn't respond to Mike, if she lets Mike sit with himself and sit with his behavior and sit with God, perhaps God and Mike will figure out how Mike's behavior needs to change. Kim does not need to do that. That's not her job. Mm-hmm. So I think that's, for me, what I struggle with is this acceptance. Like, I'll see it. I'll see something going on, and I see this in my family all the time. And I'm like, that's the thing. That's the thing.
Let me do a favor. Let me put this on hold for a minute, go through the lesson, and see if you don't see what happens when you allow God to take down your walls. Allow God to take down the walls of you being right, and you're going to stand there no matter what because you're right. You've got to allow that battle. You've got to allow that destruction because you aren't always right. Even if you think, oh no, I've got the Bible on my side. Well, as soon as you say that, you've just made an us and them argument. So you're not right.
See, but I feel like
okay, but see, right. And made it. That's exactly what's happening. That's what you're doing. But see, once you do that, you know that you're in a battle, and you're not willing to say, I'm making an us and them. And that's the big battle, right? That's the battle of independence he wants to pull down.
And we have to call that hard. It is really hard.
Yes.
To make not only yourself vulnerable, but your children.
Right.
That's
really
hard.
Yep.
I think that's what's the loss. Like the loss of being able to protect your family from something that feels kind of gross. Yeah.
And the funny thing is, protecting your family from some hard realities, this is what we do in the schools now. We're going to protect everyone from ever feeling loss. So everybody gets a trophy.
Oh, geez.
Really? Really? It's not life. It's not truth. And so now we have this idea that we can always be right and that we have to protect. That our duty is to protect our children from life. So let me go on because I think we need to understand that independence is so strong, and I'm going to say this again and again and again. Independence is so strong in us that we've sewn it onto our body, and for some reason, trapping it off is just, we just don't want to do it. It's just too painful to do it.
Well, and the reality is we have set up our lives in our country and everything on winners and losers,
right.
You know, and battle, and everything is a battle. So these are really hard questions.
Yeah, they are. They are. And made it. I'm so glad that you're able to say this because everybody else is sitting here wanting to, with the same kind of thing. They're saying, you know, well, no, like I've got this issue and I want to win it basically, and that's actually not. Actually, God is never calling us to win anything. He's already done the winning. So now I think you've got enough time to know that you all have rubble, right? Whether you've accepted the fact that God's trying to tear your walls or not. Sometimes you haven't let him tear the walls down. Then you don't have rubble to deal with. And here's what you're going to find out. The rubble is really precious. I can't tell you that I would have as deep of a relationship with Christ today had I not allowed, well, there was nothing I could do. He just destroyed my walls. And the rubble is what brought the life today. So what I want you to do is I'm going to pass around a lot of rubble, all these pebbles. I want you to take a handful, and I want you to hold the handful of rubble from your own lives and think through the rubble where you've allowed God to destroy your independent walls, where you've allowed God to take down or expose your hidden spoils. To me, that word exposure is one of those great things because, you know, this is what he did for me. He just completely exposed me. And we never think that's a really cool thing, right? I have to tell you, today I was thinking through, what can we do for the brunch? I think we should go through the ordination process. Yeah, how could we do that? And I'm sitting here thinking, those women would never come back. Yeah. None of them would come back because nobody wants to be naked. Well, Robin and Kristen might. They would come back.
We have a
bad one time. But that's it, right? None of us really wants to be exposed. But we can't be washed and we can be clothed in what Christ wants to clothe us in without being washed, without being exposed. So the rubble is bringing down those walls so we can be exposed. Now, I want you to hold that. I'm going to do a little bit of teaching and I want you to keep holding that. So you might want to hold it in your non-writing hand. There's a subtle shift now. From all the battles that came from Gilgal, now the shift from the base camp in Gilgal to Shiloh. In essence, the battles are done. Now, in reality, no, they're going to have more battles. We'll talk about that. But in essence, Joshua's done talking about the battles. And now he wants to say, now that you've had some battles, live with what's left now. Go in and occupy these lands that you've had battles over. Go in and set up life now. And that life, setting up life, is going to come from Shiloh, not from Gilgal. It's going to come from Shiloh, meaning the place of safety. Safety. And eventually that word turns into shalom. But living is going to come from that place. The battles came from rolling away the reproach. What God had already done, now God's going to say, I live at Shiloh. They set up the tent of meeting in Shiloh, and he says, this is where I live. I am the safe place. I am Shiloh. Now, the fact of the matter is, we live in cycles. So it does mean that we're going to go back to battles. But there's a cycle. It's actually, we do battles, and then God says, well, now learn to live in the rubble of those battles. And then we'll do more battles. But you're not going to lose the living part of where you've lived in safety. So he's calling them, now live out of me being the safe place. You've been living in battle mode, now live in safe mode. Now you can actually start to settle into the land. You can start to settle into the land that has now been created where the battles have destroyed some things in your life. And now there's a place for you to live. It looks like a place of rubble. That's where he's asking you to place live, but he says it is actually a place of safety. So we went from battle in Gilgal to security in Shiloh, the place where God dwells. So we add a little bit more to that. God saying, here I am, here you are, here we are together. Now he says, who am I? I'm the place of safety. Who are you? You're the one who needs a place of safety. Who are we together? Together, we can create and grow the places of safety, which is what he's always been telling us, right? He's restoring us. The battle needed to come to tear down what we'd built. And now he's restoring us to be back in Eden, where we start to do what we were told to do in the first place. Be fruitful and multiply. Make more priests. Make the place into a city. That's what he's been talking about. That's what he's saying now. Now you're in Shiloh. Start settling down. Start settling and making cities. Start actually populating this country that we're going to call Israel so that you can be the model for all others. So he says, I'm going to secure the place. Remember, it's always God who goes first. God rolled away the reproach. Now you live it. Now he's saying, I've made the safe place. Now live it. Together, let's expand that. Let's expand that safe place to live. So by his direction, he parcels out the possessions of the land. Okay, here's where you can go and make a safe place. Here's where you can grow my safe presence into another place. Here's how you can do it. And how does he do that? How does Joshua and Eliezer actually decide where each tribe is going to go?
By lots.
By lots. Okay? So, you know, I scrambled thinking, oh my gosh, this is the first lesson that there aren't any stones or rocks. Mm-hmm. Guess what lots means? Pebbles. It means pebbles. Oh, because they used pebbles to throw the decisions. But they knew that it was God directing. That was a very common way of asking God, what do you want us to do? And so they used pebbles here and they threw them. But obviously, the pebbles are in God's possession now because the pebbles are what came from the battles, right? From the destruction, from destroying your independent ways. Now there's left with pebbles, and God has them. You've given him the right to destroy it all. You've joined him in battle. Now he's got pebbles. What is he going to do with the pebbles? And just like I said, you've got pebbles now. You've got rubble in your hand from things God has destroyed that you've allowed him. Yep, I'm going with you in this battle. Because sometimes we don't allow those battles, right? And we fight against him, and we don't let him bring down those walls. But the pebbles are from the walls we've let him bring down. Those are amazing, precious things that you have in your hand because those are places that you've let him take down your walls of independence. Now he's going to use them, and he's going to roll those lots, and he's going to roll them to give you new places to live, places that you can actually be a priest. So what he's taken down, where you've allowed him to take things down, he's going to use those pebbles now as the building stones of being priest, of living in the priest, of being and living in a place that you expand the safe place to be and to live. So the rubble, the letting him take you into battle is a great thing because the pebbles left over are what he uses to actually give you a place to live. So what he does is he takes those pebbles and he makes those pebbles move now. Those pebbles by themselves are just sitting there. But he throws them, and he makes them move, and he makes them living pebbles or living stones, which, of course, 1 Peter talks about, right? You there now are living stones created to build a royal priesthood, a place for us to dwell, so that you may, in that place, because you have let him use those pebbles, those rubbles, that you may now proclaim the excellencies of his life, of what he has for you. That's what 1 Peter is talking about, is exactly what's happening here in Joshua. So, as long as I'm holding on to his hand and allowing him to throw my pebbles now and let him use those pebbles into making a city where safety is possible, where vulnerability and reality living with him as a priest is possible. That's what I'm going to build with that. That's what I have the availability to build. Now, I can't take those pebbles on my own. He's going to distribute them. This really does have a parallel when we talk about, when 1 Corinthians talks about it is God who distributes the gifts and he will give you the gifts as he determines. Those are the places where you begin to build your priesthood. When you accept those gifts, he chooses, not you, he chooses. And he's going to choose the places where you're going to rebuild. But what he's saying to the Israelites here is, go now. Would you go and settle these lands? I've given you all this. I'm giving you pebbles now to rebuild. Stop sitting around and going, well, that's nice. Go. You're living pebbles now. Would you dance? It's just like, don't just sit there. I've made you alive. I've given you a new life and a life to be a priest in that doesn't have walls of independence. Go now, do that. Join me in that safe place. Come out together with me to make a safe place. Don't be satisfied to just sit there and say, oh, that's great that he did that, that he brought down my walls. No, now let's do something in that place. The lots, the pebbles, will now begin to build the city that we see in Revelation eventually. But the city, and remember, Israel is being built up so that it is the model of the city of where we're all priests. So before you have cramps in your hands over all those pebbles, I want you to put those pebbles in your city so that you know that the rubble of all the places that God has brought you loss, taken down your independence walls, is actually for good, and it's actually building the city of priests, right? So I don't know how to pass these out best. Go ahead and take a city and put your pebbles in that city. And this is what I would have you do. Take these home, and every time you have a battle for the next year, go get some pebbles. Hold those pebbles.
I need a big gallon-sized container.
And when you accept that as a gift, that the battle was a gift, and you want to let God use the rubble, then put it in your city, knowing that God is helping you to build a city where you are able to be a priest, where you are able to offer to others a place of openness and safety that they can be vulnerable and real and realize their own priesthood and not just their harlotry.
Okay, now it's the right size container.
The fact that he goes over, and I don't remember who it was, somebody emailed me and said, what's with the borders over and over again? Yeah, that's important. Here's remember, he's using Israel to build a whole model. And so he tells them, here's your border. Now go and fill it to the border, so that when you have all taken your whole possession and fully embraced it and fully embraced all the rubble and rebuilt, fill to the border. Once you've done that, the whole country looks like one. All the borders, you can't see the borders anymore if you fill them. The borders are only a problem if you don't fill to the brim, if you don't embrace your whole possession, because then it looks like we're all separate. But it's you taking your whole possession, you allowing all the walls to come down, you allowing him to use all the rubble to build up. Live out to the borders, so that if I'm living to my, notice every one of those borders, when you look at it, it says, well, they had a, there's a couple times I put a question mark. What are you talking about? Ephraim has a border to Jerusalem, and so does Judah. What? Yeah, that's the point. Their borders are smack up against each other, so that when they fill them, they're all one. Does that make sense? Kind of like, this is funny. So I never covered the pop rocks from the mouth, the rocks that were going in our mouth. I forgot to cover them. What happened to them? I mean, they're just sitting here. One solid thing. That's actually the picture of what is supposed to be happening in Israel if they fill to their borders. I can't see the different rocks now, right? It's one massive piece. That's what Israel's supposed to be. If each one fills to their borders, if each one takes all the battles and then builds, uses them, allows God to use those to be priests in all the places, all the way to the end of the borders, you won't see the borders anymore. Does that make sense?
Mm-hmm.
That's why the borders are important there. So
it's like DuPage County. When we first moved here, there was open space between Hinsdale and the next town,
mm-hmm.
and the next town,
mm-hmm.
between Naperville and Lyle. There were farms, open space between Naperville and Aurora. Farms and open space, and now you can't tell what city you're in unless you
right.
see the sign.
Right, exactly.
Because they're right
yep. yeah.
together.
Exactly.
Except, well, the streets change names.
yeah, right.
Weber,
right.
As soon as
right.
Longer, I mean, Maple Avenue becomes Chicago Avenue as soon as you run it down. I mean, you know.
Yeah, so that's exactly it. And that's how it's supposed to look. That's what he wants. So that means that we, completely taking possession of our priesthood, is essential to the wholeness of the priesthood. So your rubble starts to build cities. And of course, now he's going to talk about a specific city that he wants us to build. And I'll let Sherilyn take it from there.
I wonder if some of our fear of giving it up is that we are sure we know how it's going to turn out.
No,
getting that God is good. You know what I mean?
No, I can't.
Like a lot of times in my mind, I'm like, I'm sure that if I give up independence here and let just God be in control, I am sure I know how it's going to end up. And I'm not usually right.
Yeah.
You know, forgetting that God is good and he's working out a good thing and I can trust him with keeping out my control of it because he is doing something good.
Right.
Hmm.
Right. Well, the interesting thing that happens when they cast lots, right? So they have the, you know, you may have noticed, like, the Levites end up being all over the place. You know, they don't have a space. They don't have a border. They don't have a land where they're going to live. They're spread out everywhere among all these different cities. 48, I think it was. And I think I just want to, like, say right now, because I feel the heaviness of that, the pebbles. It's so hard to live in rubble. It's so much easier to live in something that looks clean and safe and protected in our ways, you know, in your walls. I don't know, just before I talk about this city of refuge, I just kind of wanted to pray for us, because, like, my heart, like, when you were speaking, I know that hardness, you know, it's hard. It is hard to live in rubble. It is hard for it not to look safe and all tidy. It is hard to just have God go whoosh, and you don't know where you're going to end up. You end up in some city over there, and guess what? You're kind of by yourself. You're kind of by yourself as a priest there, because you don't get to live with all the priests. I mean, we like kind of going to church all the time because we feel safe and we're, like, with people who are like us. The fact of the matter is, God's like, no, actually, I don't want the Levites all together. I don't. I want them spread out among all the tribes and all the cities. And that gets really hard and lonely. And I think that's why this purpose behind that with a city of refuge is so important to understand. Because God does not put us and scatter us for our destruction, for our loneliness. He does it for a purpose. So let me just pray. Lord, as we talk about this city of refuge, and we even see how you yourself are an embodiment of that city, and how you want us as priests to be an embodiment and a representation of your refuge, would you just... would you let us rest in that place? We're so used to battle mode, fighting for our rights and our boundaries, that we forget that you've already established our boundaries. You've already given us a place to live, and that there is another way. There is another way to live in safety and security, even when you're feeling alone and like you're living among rubble. Lord, would you just show up in this place right now, in this teaching, in this moment, where you tell us about your refuge? Because the truth is, although we are all wanting to be a refuge to others, we are also all people who are in need of refuge, and we're in need of running to you for refuge in our rubble. We just thank you for being a refuge, Jesus. Amen.
When you do that, like, it kind of makes you feel like the roll of the dice, like you don't know.
It is. That's what the... So it used to be pebbles, and now we have dice. You know what I mean? But that was the way you rolled to figure things out,
yeah,
you know,
yeah,
was a lot. And so then, of course, you have that show up again, you know, and when they're rolling things for Jesus and tearing him apart and that sort of thing. But yeah, it develops over time into kind of something different. And the same thing happens with cities of refuge. They're meant to be a certain way. And then over time, we kind of create them to be something completely different than what they were meant. So there's only 9 verses in chapter 20, and I was surprised, and I'm like, oh my goodness, there's so much going on. There's so much going on in these 9 verses. And of course, when I'm talking about these, I also went to a couple other places, like Numbers 35, Deuteronomy. Jill shared with me the Talmud. So when you're like, I totally didn't see that, I just want you to know, I totally didn't see it either when I first looked at it. I had to kind of go to these other places to inform what the Israelites already knew about the cities of refuge when Joshua was talking to them. So this is, again, this isn't the first time it's come up. Every time God was talking about the land and them going to live in the land, he had introduced this idea of the city of refuge and had been way more specific than he is here. And these are a couple of things for the purpose of the city of refuge, which I think is just beautiful, because there's this reality, right? Like, he's like, here's your land, go live in it. And you all want to, you know, it's like when you move into a new house or whatever, you're like, you just see the white picket fence and the beautiful life we're going to have when we take out the for sale sign, and this is going to be great. And then, like, reality sets in. We're people, and we're people who hurt people, and things happen, and it isn't all just beautiful that we have a house and we have land. It gets really, really messy. And so God knows this. He's not reacting and surprised by our messes, right? That, oh, I gave you a house. Why couldn't you guys keep it together? Why couldn't you just do family in a nice way? I gave you that. He knows. We are messy. There's blood on our hands. This is how we live. And so he reminds them again in Joshua, hey, remember, every time I talk to you about the land, these cities of refuge, you need to have, when you're settling into security, a state of grace. You need to have a state of grace. And these states of grace, in the physical sense, were these cities of refuge. So what would happen is, you know, somebody would, in this case, you know, unintentionally hurt someone else. I mean, really, unintentionally kill someone else is what's going on in this particular passage. And that, I mean, think about it. Somebody accidentally runs over your child in a car. That really affects your neighborhood. That really affects the way you guys are living, right? Suddenly you were like all happy neighbors, and then like people feel the need to start taking sides, right? Well, she didn't mean to, and I'm friends with her, and they didn't mean to do that to your child. Someone else is like, that was horrible. They should always look in the rearview mirror. That should da da da. Yeah.
Halloween.
Yes.
Pouring rain. A couple moms got together, said, let's do trick or treating on Friday.
Mm-hmm.
To actually get all excited about, but
right.
So it doesn't have to be something that significant.
Exactly, right. And suddenly something as fun as getting candy has got people on different sides,
yes.
Right?
Yeah.
I'm on the side of keep it as it is. I'm on the side of
okay,
yeah, right. So exactly. So I mean, you can see how these unintentional things end up being division and don't really make everybody feel like this is a place of security anymore. So if someone found themselves in that situation, they would run, they would flee. They would flee to one of these six cities. They would show up at the gate, and they would wait at the gate for the priest to come to the gate and basically state their case, kind of confess the situation, right? So here you have a person, they're fleeing for refuge. They get to refuge. They're like, this is what happened, da da da. And the priest basically says, all right, in the name of the high priest of the time, so we're all the priests are representatives of the high priest. In the name of the high priest, I will agree to cover you, and you can come in and live in the city. Because the truth is, he's not going to have much of a life back at the old city. So he needs to find a new life. And so they come to this, and he agrees to cover. Now, my first thought with covering, in my head, I don't know about you guys, I was like, oh, this is kind of like the witness protection program, right? You know, you think, oh, yeah, you put them in a new city, you set them up, they live among people, and it's a witness protection program. But the interesting thing about witness protection is that, right, what's going on there? There's like secrecy. You know what I mean? There's like deception. There's like, oh, I'm not that person. I'm someone else. That never happened. You know, and you live as if that other thing never happened and you're starting over. But that's, God knows that doesn't work, right? Kind of pretending things never happen, either for the person to stay in that city, like, oh, that never happened that little Johnny fell under that wheel of my car, like that, or even going to a new city and pretending it never happened. Both of those are not life, right? So God lays out this thing. No, actually, you come as you are. You come and you go, yeah, this happened, and this was a mess, and I'm not going to pretend to live under some other name. I'm coming, you know, for refuge. And the priest agrees to cover him. Now, the covering, as we know from the people of Israel, whenever there's like a cover for sin, I mean, that essentially means death, right? Someone's absorbing your sin, paying the penalty, because you have the sacrificial system. You don't just like, oh, I got you covered. That's what we say now. But at that time, it's like, no, I will take on the penalty for your sin in the name of the high priest. The high priest is going to take on the penalty for that. And so what would happen is, that sin was absorbed by the high priest until the high priest died. Because every sin has to have a payment, right?
Covering your debt.
Yeah, there needs to be a payment. So once the high priest died, there, that would satisfy that payment for that sin. They would say, you know what? Okay, now there's been a payment, there's been a death, and that person can now be restored back to their community. Does that make sense? So then the people back there would be satisfied because somebody died for that crime. You know what I mean? Someone died for that crime, that's satisfied, they can be restored. There's been, you know, some time for healing. And that's kind of the picture of what's going on when they flee. Now, the other aspect of this that's neat is it was also a place to dwell. So it wasn't like, you know, hey, you know, go live in this jail or this house where other people like you who come to us and who aren't really of our tribe, because that's, they wouldn't be of their tribe. This is a town of all the different tribes, you know. It wouldn't be like, why don't you guys go live in this house? No, they were integrated. They were like, you dwell among us. You get to, part of grace is being able to be with and not separated, right? I mean, you don't feel much grace from someone in pardon if you're having to be living separate. I mean, how many people who are, you know, prisoners, even if they're pardoned, but they still have to live in jail for the rest of their life, they're not feeling a whole lot of grace in that situation. Grace comes in being with and not being separated, right? So that's going on too. They're saying, we'll take on your sin and we'll allow you to live with us, to the extent that the priest was even like the model. And you know, if things weren't going well, I mean, he had to like, all right, let me help you get a job, let me help you get food, let me help you get set up. He was responsible for all of that and was supposed to essentially show the rest of the people in the town what it looks like to dwell with someone who's a manslayer, right? Because, I mean, I can guarantee that the rest of the people in, let's say, the tribe of Manasseh or Asher are like, here comes that guy. Here comes that guy who killed that kid in that one town. I am not going to be friends with that. Like, just let him do his own thing. Let him be the priest problem. But the priest was like, no, I'm going to be a model of how to do life with and integrated. So manslayer, right? Did anybody else go, what? That's such a weird word. You know what I mean? It's like, it kind of stands out when you see it. That and Avenger of Blood. When you look at that word, as we like to do, is look at words here, what their meaning is. The word manslayer means one who breaks or dashes into pieces. So what's good about knowing that is when I hear manslayer, I don't really think I'm a manslayer. When I hear breaking or dashing into pieces, okay, now we're getting a little closer to something I might do, you know? And that is essentially what that word meant, one who broke or dashed into pieces. Now, when we're in these Old Testament books, something we have to remember and that Jill brings up a lot is that we're dealing with people in the, you know, stage of life of a toddler, essentially, spiritually. You know, once Jesus is on the scene, we're kind of moving into like an adulthood and into another level of understanding. But in Joshua, these are physical things, you know. So in Joshua's time, I mean, I think about my daughter, Sophia, who's 5. When she was 2, when I said, don't hurt someone, I really meant, don't punch them. Don't bite them. You know, it was very physical. And her understanding of hurting someone was very, very physical. And in fact, to be honest, I would really only discipline her for physical manifestations of hurting someone. Because she wasn't at the point where she would understand that hurting could have been the way she looked at someone, the way she didn't share, you know, the way she said something, her tone. You know, she wouldn't get that. She wouldn't get like, what do you mean at 2? My tone? No, it was a biting, it was a hitting. Same thing here. When God is introducing this idea of breaking or dashing into pieces, he's starting with something really basic, physical death. Physical death. You physically hurt someone, you physically broke them. But we're going to see, like, as Israel grows up, and then when you see Jesus, of course, I mean, I almost want someone to, if someone has their Bible, to read Matthew 5, 21 through 26. Can someone do that for me? We're going to see this progression of this word manslayer into Into Jesus' Time. You're probably familiar with it, but it's definitely worth a review.
What is it in Matthew what?
5:21-26.
You have heard that the ancients were told, you shall not commit murder, and whoever commits murder shall be liable to the court. But I say to you that everyone who is angry with his brother shall be guilty before the court, and whoever shall say to his brother, Raca, shall be guilty before the Supreme Court, and whoever shall say, you fool, shall be guilty enough to go into the fiery hell. If therefore you are presenting your offering at the altar, and there remember that your brother has something against you, leave your offering there before the altar and go your way. First be reconciled to your brother, and then come and present your offering. Make friends quickly with your opponent at law while you are with him on the way, in order that your opponent may not deliver you to the judge, and the judge to the officer, and you be thrown into prison. Truly I say to you, you shall not come out of there until you have paid up the last cent.
Okay, so suddenly Jesus is saying, hey, all those consequences for killing someone, I say calling them a fool gets you the same consequence, right? Before a judge, go to jail, call you a fool. Okay, so now we're seeing, you know, when we look at something like Joshua, the temptation is, okay, so manslayer, someone who kills, you know what I mean? I'm good. Check. You know, adulterer, oh, I haven't slept with anyone else. Check. But obviously, you know, we know in the progression that we're talking about breaking or dashing into pieces in any sense of the word. There's something else that's interesting as far as the city of refuge that I forgot to mention. So the word refuge, you know, another word that's in there when you look that word up is asylum. Asylum. I don't know. What do you? I mean, when you hear that word, what kind of things come to your mind?
Insane.
Insane. Asylum, right? I mean, I had to, because I kind of volunteer with refugees. I thought, okay, there's that kind of asylum where you're seeking asylum, right? And you're coming to a country and you're seeking asylum. But we really, insane asylum comes real quick, right? And I just wanted to mention that because this idea of integration of the person of the manslayer is so crucial, because what we like to do is we like to say we'll grant you asylum, and we actually have a place called asylum. It's a special place for you who are looking for refuge. And Michelle and I were just recently on this insane road trip. And we drove from here to Smokies, Charleston, and then Savannah. So we end up in Savannah, and we're on one of these, you know, tours, these ghost tours at night. And because that's what you do in Savannah. You're in Savannah. There's like no tour of Savannah that isn't like this ghost tour. So anyway, we're on this tour, and they're like, well, the most haunted place in Savannah is actually this building right here. That used to be an insane asylum. And we're like, okay, you know, and she's like, it's probably because back in that time, there was a lot of injustices that were happening. And that we're like, okay, like what? We're like, well, you know, nowadays we think insane asylum, we just put people in with, you know, maybe some mental health. But at that time, we actually, anybody who had yellow fever or any kind of sickness, we put them in the insane asylum. You're like, oh, that's a lot of people at that time. We're not, you know, this is pre-vaccination, you know. So you're like, okay, there's a lot of people like that. Well, and then if you got pregnant outside of wedlock, then you were put into the asylum. And they're like, and then if you came to the town, you didn't know English and we couldn't understand you, well, then you were put into the asylum. Which, I mean, Savannah's like on the water. I mean, there's like, it's a port for, you know, a lot of people, and even like people who were bringing slaves but were from other countries, they didn't speak English either, so they were in there too. You know, everybody's going in. By the time she delineated everybody who ended up in this asylum, you were like, who's safe? Like, you know, and then this was the safe place, and it ended up being this place that just death, death, death. You have yellow fever, you have mental health, you have people to speak English. Like, it really created a place of death. Why? Why did it create a place of death? Because they decided we wanted asylum to be something that's separate. You know, we wanted something separate. And it's amazing. Once you separate, you find lots and lots of ways to continue to separate, right? Mm-hmm. It gets easier and easier. Well, let's start it here. And it gets easier and easier and easier to expand that. Mm-hmm. So that I'm now something to also bring up with the cities of refuge, kind of like Savannah. No, there is no record of people actually doing this. There's no record of anyone actually running to a city of refuge and being welcomed. And it's fascinating to me because it kind of speaks to, like what you were talking about, how hard this stuff really is. It is really hard to live in a mess. It is really hard to live with someone else's mess. This isn't something we want to do. We want there to be a different place for asylum. And no one ever did it. And now you think, so here's these six cities, right? Okay, so there's these six cities they bring up for cities of refuge, and they say we want them to be really accessible. And there were like three on one side of the Jordan and three on the other side of the Jordan. There were three on the north and three on the south. You know, so God was like making sure like you could get to one of these. There would be a way. There would be a way for you to accessibility, you know, to find a state of grace. Because if you had to cross the Jordan River, I mean, if it's springtime, you're screwed, right? You can't get over. It's flooded. You can't find asylum. So God was like, no, there's not going to be an obstacle for you finding a state of grace. I'm going to make it as easy as possible by spreading it out. So you have three in the north, three in the south, three in the east, three in the west. Every kind of different tribe of Israel wasn't like, you know, I don't know. We have a family feud with this tribe. We don't really want to go there. Wasn't there. So you have that. And now when you think about Israel, right, this is going to make me cry. What kind of cities are they known for right now? What are the kind of cities that are actually spread out around there? They're not cities of refuge. They're cities of repression. They're cities of repression. There's cities right now, Golan Heights, you think about, that was one of them. You think about the West Bank. Right now, they're like, oh, you're different than us and you're wanting safety, Palestinians, and we're going to put you in an asylum, in an institutional place to make you separate. And that has caused nothing but death and battle for Israel now. They are constantly in battle. They're constantly in a state of protecting themselves. They are in the land, but sensing no security. And the reason there's no security, I believe, I mean, there's probably a variety of reasons. In part, they didn't heed this idea of having a state of grace for people, having a place where we can dwell together because we understand that blood is on our hands all the time. Things happen, and we need to find a way, a priest, to cover that, to go to that, not just separate ourselves. So now we're seeing cities more of repression. God's like, no, 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 no. What I mean for life, the only way to do life, is to have this idea of a city of refuge. Now, the other thing about the city of refuge, besides like where they're scattered, is also where exactly, like their physicality. They are mainly, five out of six of these, are on mountains. Okay? You might have mentioned, you know, honestly, if I weren't to study this, I wouldn't know. Because I was like, okay, mountain under this, Mount of Ephraim, you know? But when you sit with that a little bit and you realize having a city of refuge on a mountain really helps you get to it, right? Because then you're like, oh, that's where I'm going. That's where I'm going. I'm going to that. You know, it isn't like, ooh, I got my Jeep. I mean, you know, where Siri, where is Hebron? You know what I mean? You see it. It's up on this mountain. Now, besides it being good for the manslayer, right? So he knows where he's going. He can see it. It's also good for the city, right? Because then the city can see, oh, there's a manslayer coming. They can kind of prepare for that situation. They see the manslayer coming. But they can also see if the Avenger of Blood is chasing him. And if he needs, like, a little more help than just waiting for him to come up to the gate, right? You'll be able to see if he's being pursued by the Avenger of Blood. So there's a purpose there. The one that isn't on a mountain is in a fortified city, which would also, again, would stick out because all the other places are not like that. and would also provide kind of a safe place, even if you're being pursued. So we have that as far as accessibility.
And can I just
go ahead.
I think the big picture of this is the fact that what he's saying is grace should be so easily accessible.
Yeah.
And I think the picture that we have today is we've got all these rules for people to get grace. You got to say this to get grace. Yeah, you got to cross the Jordan. You got to do this. You got to be like this. You got to live like this to get grace. And I think God's main objective here is to say grace should just be available.
Mm-hmm.
So available that it's more available than any other city. You didn't talk about the roads. You can talk about the roads.
Yeah. Yeah. So the other thing that is beautiful about the accessibility, it's on a mountain, is that in the Talmud, it talks about the roads to the city of refuge should be the first ones built when you're getting into the land. Those should be the first ones built, and they should be twice as wide as any other road. And so there's this idea, like Jill was saying, like grace needs to be so accessible to someone. And we aren't going to make any kind of obstacle to that. We're going to make it the first road. It isn't like, well, the road wasn't up yet. We're going to make it the first road, and we're going to make it twice as wide. Yeah. And, you know, you think about it, like you were saying, a lot of times we do, we kind of almost make this central place. Well, you have to kind of go through this way to get grace. And God kind of puts it all over the place. The other thing, I mean, if you're into this, that's interesting to see is if you look up the word mountain, like where's mountain in the Bible, what you're going to, like when we see hill and mountains, I think sometimes we're like, oh, city on a hill, living perfectly, oh, being a bright shining light. Like mountain did not mean standing out because you were great. You realize when you look up mountain, mountain was all about being a city of refuge, being a place of refuge. People went to find God on a mountain. Moses went up onto the mountain. He was meeting God in the mountain. A lot of the different, you know, fathers of faith, they're going to the mountain. And then when I looked at Jesus, he was actually going to a mountain a lot. And when he went to a mountain, it was to seek refuge with God. He went away. He went away from his disciples. He went up to the mountain. He went to pray. He went to this mountain. So anyway, that's an interesting exercise in and of itself, because I think our picture of mountain is actually a little bit like, look at me. I'm awesome. I'm a Christian. I shine this light. And it's not that at all. It's meant to be an accessibility for people to run to a state of grace, to be heard, to be covered, to be shown how to be covered by the high priest. And we know later, of course, that high priest becomes Jesus.
Isn't there a song or something like that? Like, go to the mountain.
Yeah.
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 Yeah. Yeah. Tell it on the mountain.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
You know, to piggyback with that, so instead of it being a place where we go, hey, look at me, I'm a city on a hill, it's, hey, look at me, I need refuge. That's that whole vulnerability picture again.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
Look, I need refuge.
Yeah.
That Jesus did that all the time.
Yeah.
I need refuge.
Well, and did Jesus modeled
yeah.
finding refuge in God? I mean, he was God, so you're like, oh, he wouldn't have to, what, be baptized? He wouldn't have to go find refuge in God. But he models that for us, you know, over and over again.
Don't the comics depict that? Like, the guy climbed the mountain to find the answer to his question.
Yeah. Yeah.
I mean,
yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. It's just kind of a comic way of looking at it, but the same
right.
way.
Right. Yeah. And this, you know, I don't know. I remember the worship song, like, I'm coming up the mountain, Lord, you know, I'm seeking you. And you, like, this is, when we see mountains, it's a picture of refuge. It's a picture of refuge, or at least it should be. That would be why you would sit yourself on a mountain in God's kingdom. What else was I going to say with that as far as sitting on a mountain? I felt like there was something else there. So anyway, as you know, besides these pictures, right? So God gives us the picture of the high priest absorbing the sin. I mean, beautiful picture. Picture of refuge of the priest. Actually, the high priest at that time can't be everywhere. So you have the picture of the scattering, the Levitical priest being everywhere. Oh, I know. There. This reminds me of something Jen said like a couple weeks ago.
the other thing that's kind of interesting is the person, the manslayer, has a choice of what city to go to, right? Mm-hmm. They have a choice. But the priest in the city itself of refuge doesn't really have a choice of who comes to them. Like, their responsibility isn't to choose who comes to them, but to receive who does. And I think I forget, like, when someone comes to me for refuge, that's like an honor, you know, that's an honor. They didn't go to any other city. They came to my city for refuge, you know? And then I would, you know, grumble that they came to my city. I mean, these are probably things that happened then. Oh, there's another one coming to our city. How many can this city take? You know, but, you know, God scatters them, and he in advance knows that what he's bringing to us. I think we have to rest and trust in the people who come to our city of refuge. You know what I mean? That's a divine thing who comes, and we don't have to manage that. You know, the other reality too is there is going to be a level of modeling for us, for other people, because people are going to grumble that you're with a manslayer. I mean, that's the truth of the matter. You know, that's uncomfortable for people. You know, I remember we used to host refugees at people seeking asylum at our house. And there was this girl, head to toe, 5 years old. Head to toe in, Lissa, I'm like blanking on it, hijab. And, you know, our neighbors are kind of like, are you serious? There's like people from Somalia in your house covered head to toe. I can't even see their face. You know what I mean? And I think like this, I mean, this is kind of, honestly, that's an easy one. What's harder is when it's like somebody who is, like it's okay to be there, but they're just messy. You know, someone can almost like in the name of cultural awareness be like, okay, they have people from Somalia. The harder part is like when you have the alcoholic, when you have the, you know, someone who's addicted to drugs or has been in the mental hospital, and then that's who you're with. You know what I mean? But I mean, that was the job of the priest. It was to show the rest of the town, this is what we're called to do, and we've got to model how to do it right. So as God would have it, he has these six towns, and of course he gives them names, because God gives us all names, right? And his names are never random. There's always meaning behind what God names, you know? And so it is with the cities of refuge. And I'm just going to go through real quick what these cities are. You probably read them. One of them is Kadesh. The word Kadesh means to sanctify or to make holy. The second one is Shechem. And we're going to talk a little more about that one later. If you read the red tent, that might like spark something for you. That's called Between the Shoulders or Burden Bearer. So Burden Bearer. That Kiriath Arba is another word for Hebron, which means joining or fellowship. The Bezer is a fortified place. And Golan is to remove or deliver. Now, what's really cool about that is when you look at all those words together, to sanctify, to bear the burden, to join, raise up, deliver. I mean, that's a picture of like what the high priest does. You know what I mean? What refuge looks like. When it's all together, when they're all brought together, this is what refuge, deliverance looks like. But the truth is, they were all given different names. They weren't all given the same name. And I think that's the same for us, right? You know, the way that like Robin is a refuge is totally different than probably the way I'm a refuge. You know, the way Pat is a refuge is different than the way Kim is a refuge. And so we kind of have different names and ways that we bring refuge, you know? And that's all very good. And I think we have to give ourselves, yes.
You skipped over Ramoth Gilead.
Oh, Ramoth.
Which means to uplift.
Uplift, okay. Thank you. Ramoth to lift up. But I think when we talk about different, like, styles, because every one of those cities probably operated a little differently in the way they brought refuge, you know? I mean, there was, like, these ideals, but the way that was lived out was a little differently, like us. I just real quick want to speak to this idea that we sometimes get in our heads that, like, refuge is like this, like, stairway, right? Like, first we bring refuge to our kids, and then when we get much better at that, we do it to, like, our neighbors, and then when we're better than that, we do it to prisoners and refugees and da-da. But I think we've been, you know, for some of us have been in this study long enough to know that, like, that God doesn't work that way. Mm-hmm. He works this way. Mm-hmm. Do you know what I mean? And I don't know about you, but sometimes I'm learning the lesson that I already learned 20 years ago, and I'm learning it again. And I think that's the same thing with this idea of refuge, is that, you know, with me, God first started actually with refugees. And you people on the outside are like, oh, she must be really good at bringing refuge. She's bringing refuge to people in a hijab who are Shia Muslims. And then all of a sudden, my walls came crumbling down, and I realized I didn't even know how to give refuge to my son with a mental illness. Like, I wasn't doing well with that at all. I wasn't showing compassion to him at all. I was, like, frustrated. You know, I was like, oh, why is this happening to me? You know what I mean? Why is this person at my gate? And it's, like, my own kid, you know? But it looked like I was so great at it with this, you know. I think we have to, free each other to know that, like, sometimes we have a season where that person that we're bringing refuge is very, very close to us. And sometimes it gets a little further out. And a little further out, and then sometimes it comes back in. And it isn't so much about getting better at being refuge. It isn't about getting better. It's about receiving what God brings to your gate. Sometimes that's your child, sometimes that's your neighbor, sometimes that's a prisoner or refugee. But we need to be open. Who's at our gate? And kind of examine that. I think the final thing I just wanted to say on this is, It's really fun in a way, or at least for me, maybe I'm kind of weird, to talk about, like, yes, we're going to be a refuge. You know, it's very motivating, you know, inspiring, like, I'm going to be the city of refuge. And now when I think of City on a Hill, I'm going to think of myself as refuge and be open to receiving people. I mean, it gets messy, but conceptually it feels kind of nice to have that purpose. But as we know with God, he works in these tensions, these dual tensions, right? And we already know that we're harlots and priests, right? We've already experienced that. Well, now in this chapter, he's reminding us, or he's going to in the next chapter, I should say, that yes, we're harlots and priests. And then when it comes to this, we're also refuge and manslayer, right? We're not just the person who gives refuge. Sometimes we're the person who really needs refuge. And I think we've talked about enough this, or actually, I mean, something that you could even go back and do this week is like what Jill was doing before, is to really, I think you're a better refuge when you realize you're somebody who needs refuge. There's nothing worse than someone who makes you feel like charity. Do you know what I mean? I remember my friend who was adopted, and it was so hard for her. Because it always seemed like they were doing her this gigantic favor by having her in her house, you know? They didn't do the with, right? But when you get the sense that you essentially were someone adopted by God and how amazing that is, you're going to be a little bit better at that. Mm-hmm. And the same is true, I think, for refuge. It's like a healthy exercise, I think, on a regular basis is to examine ourselves. How am I a manslayer? How do I break people? How do I dash people to pieces? You know, I know Kim and Jen, you were talking about, I mean, gosh, it's so easy for me to break the people closest to me. I mean, my husband probably gets broken more than most anybody in my life, you know? Like, you know, there's a variety of ways you can break people. You can break them by not saying something. You can break them by saying something. You don't encourage them. You criticize them. You know, there's all these variety of ways. But I want to encourage us, when you think about being a refuge, you're going to be way better at it if you spend some regular time examining how you're a manslayer, how you also have blood on your hands and that you've broken and dashed to pieces. And chapter 21, which Jill's going to finish us off with, essentially is reminding the Levites that they sometimes, even as Levites, are going to be those people who are going to need refuge.
So, of course, when we come to the last chapter, it talks all about the Levites and the Levite cities. So that's 48 cities as opposed to just the six. The six are Levite cities, but we have 48. So now we're talking about the whole clan of Levi. And they are to ensure that there is a model of service. Because remember, we've talked about how we've gone through really the service of ordaining a priest. And we've started out with choosing. We started out with anointing. Remember all those undressing, washing, dressing again. At this point, we're at the consecration to service. So they're consecrating the service. The funny thing is, today I'm reading First Things this morning, and there is this article about somebody who went to somebody's ordination, and he gives the prayer of ordination. And it's exactly what's happening in this chapter, which was so exciting to see what the prayer of ordination is. Even today, it talks about this. Ensure that you're a model of service. So in doing that, the Levites needed to uphold the model of us. That was the biggest thing they needed to do, was uphold that model of us. As Sherilyn said before, the model could not be a model of charity, how we talk about charity today. We talk about charity as, we've got so much and you don't have anything, so we're going to give it to you. The greater is giving to the lesser. That's not the model of a priest. The model of a priest is, we're us. So we're just all giving together. We're all living together. Understand that, because we have made the idea of priesthood kind of one of this on a pedestal, right? We do this with whether you have a pastor or a priest or whatever you call the person who preaches to you. We put them up there like he doesn't need anything. He's just giving you stuff because he's got so much to give you. The model of a priest is not that. The model of a priest is living amongst, living together. And so he's got to make sure that he instills two specific things. One is humility and one is dependability, so that they understand really what the model of us looks like, really what the model of a priest looks like. So in order to keep humility alive, what we have at this in this last chapter of 21 is that the Levites come up. Now everyone's been given their land, and the Levites come up and say, hey, guess what? God promised us a land too, and we want it. Now, when you read that out of context, you think, well, that's kind of brazen of them. Actually, it's a whole passage of humility for them to say that. Because Levites don't get anything, right? They just get some cities to live in. They don't even get to own those cities. They get cities to live in. They don't get land. So they're not coming going, hey, wait, Judah got all that land and Simeon got all that. Well, let's not talk about Simeon.
They got some pasture land, though.
They got pasture land.
For their flocks,
but it wasn't theirs. We'll talk about that. That was actually because their flocks aren't for them. Their
right,
flocks
the
are for the sacrifices.
Sacrifice.
So the fact that the Levites are coming and saying, hey, God promised us something too. Give it to us. What they're finally saying is, we accept that God knows better than we do what is life for us. And we want it. We want what God wants to give us. Not what we decide and not what we determine. We're so thrilled that this is what God is giving us. Which, in reality, guys, I don't think any of you would have been real thrilled. When everybody else gets the possessions and Levi's told, you don't get a possession. Your possession is me. And, you know, as all of us nice Christians, we'd all go, oh, yeah, that's wonderful. But really, really underneath, we're going, you're kidding me. They got that house over there, and I get you? Well, okay, God, that's really nice. But, right? But see, the Levites have come to realize God knows what's best for them. They are humble, not only in saying, okay, God, I'll take it. They're like, give it to us. Yes, thank you. This is what we want. We know that God has what's best. He knows better than we know what is good for us. They're not whining. They're thrilled to claim what God has given us. If God has given you this possession, they're excited to have it. You should be excited to have it, whatever that possession might be.
And they do it while knowing who they are. First and foremost, the Levites are murderers by choice. What do I mean by that? Well, some of you know the story of Levi, of what he did all the way back in Genesis. When we come up, here's an interesting thing. The Israelites, before they ever went to Egypt, come to a place called Shechem. Oh, wasn't that one of the city of refuges? Mm-hmm. Yeah, it was. They come to Shechem, and they actually come to there to settle. Abraham actually buys a piece of that land, and Jacob buys a piece of that land. Jacob has a daughter, Dinah. Dinah goes out to visit the people of the land, and she gets raped. And she gets raped actually by the prince of Shechem. Who is Shechem? That's his name. But Shechem actually loves Dinah. He wants to marry her. So he asks the Israelites, Jacob and the sons, I want to marry her. So they say, well, fine, but you have to become one people with us. Well, that's good, right? Because that's kind of what we did with the Gibeonites. You become one people with us. And in order to become one people with us, all of your men need to be circumcised. And the people of Shechem wanted to become one people with them. And so they said, fine, all of our adult men will become circumcised. So they circumcised them. And on the third day, surprise, surprise, what should have been new life for these men, right? Which is what Israel was supposed to do, give them new life. Levi, along with his brother Simeon, anybody know what they do?
Yeah, they kill them all.
Yeah, they come and kill them all. They're at their weakest point, a point of vulnerability that they forced on them, and they come and kill them in order to cover their desire for revenge, what they wanted, what they thought should come out of this. There's much more to the story, but that's the basic thing. They know that they have now decided what's best and how they're going to do it, and they're going to use God to cover them up, right? They're saying, oh, yes, come into covenant with us. Get circumcised. And they use that to hit them at their most vulnerable point. They force them to be vulnerable, and then they say, ha, we're going to use it for us. So we have, when Jacob actually ends up blessing his sons at the end of his life, Jacob blesses each of his sons, which are prophecies for what will happen to them. And he actually blesses Levi, saying, you have used your sword for vengeance. Which is interesting, because we've talked about the sword being the word, right? You've used your sword for vengeance rather than for life. You've used it to cover. You've used it to cut off. Therefore, I will scatter you. You will not be able to live together. Mm-hmm. Now we come here and we see that the Levites are scattered. Why? Because of what they did so many years ago, what Levi, the father of the tribe, actually did that carried over there. So that seems like rubble, doesn't it? They have, because of what they've done, they've been cursed. But remember that word cursed? To take away the power of living that way. God says, I'm going to take away the power of living that way because you are going to be part of this community that I want to lift up that is a model of a priest, of what it means to be a priest to one another. I can't have you live that way, so I'm going to scatter you. So that looks like rubble. That looks like a loss, right? A loss. This tribe now, everybody under Levi, now will never get to live together as a tribe. Wow, what a loss. And yet, what God does is he uses that rubble to scatter them all over Israel so that they are the very priests. What he does is actually choose them to be the priestly tribe. The people who actually did just the opposite. God chose them in the midst of their sin to say, you will be mine. And how he does is he actually says, I get the firstborn of remember in Egypt, he says, I get the firstborn. Well, instead of the firstborn from every tribe and every family, I will just take all the Levites as my firstborn. They will be my firstborn, which is a huge honor. They will be my firstborn, and I will take them and scatter them so that I am everywhere, so that the model of priesthood is everywhere, so that the rubble, and the Levites accepted this, we see here, we see it in other places, The Levites say, yes, we know that God knows what's best. This is good for us. This is good for us that we don't get a possession except to be God's possession and him be our possession. So I would like to read that, actually. Genesis 49, 5 through 7 is the Simeon and Levi are brothers. Simeon gets a similar thing. Their scattering is a little different. Their swords are implements of violence. Let my soul not enter their council. Let not my glory be united with their assembly. Because in their anger they slew men, and in their self-will they lamed oxen. Cursed be their anger, for it is fierce, and their wrath, for it is cruel. I will disperse them in Jacob and scatter them in Israel. So there we have that. Interesting that they now become the ones who head up the cities of refuge, isn't it? Mm-hmm. Here they are, murderers. Guys, this is exactly how Aaron became a priest, right? Mm-hmm. Aaron is the one who leads them into idolatry, and then God says, Aaron, come on here. You're going to be my high priest. Mm-hmm. And everyone knows it. Everyone knows the Levites' sin here. And for them, they would encompass that, oh, the Levites are the one where they killed a people who wanted to come into covenant. See, God purposely brings that person here. He purposely brings Saul to make him Paul, right? Because he was the one who was trying to cut off mm-hmm. Jesus' followers, mm-hmm. and he makes him. Okay, now you stand here. Why? Because God says, you've got to be us. You've got to show that you are no different than anyone else. You've got to be us. You can't be like, you can't have earned this position because then you're not us. And you can't minister like that. If you're someone who's earned that position, you can't minister. If I'm teaching you and I'm saying to you, and I do this right all the time. If all my examples are, oh, this is how I do this. This is how I do it wonderfully. But what are my examples? Hopefully my examples are all of my failure, right? Because I need you to know I'm us. I need to know I'm us. The Levites know that they are us, and everyone else knows that they are us. Interesting, when Psalms, sorry about that, is that yours? Psalm talks about their words. I have to read this because I thought it was so beautiful. Did I write it down somewhere? Psalm 64. Look up Psalm 64. This is them talking about, this is David talking about the same thing. Verse 3. Those who have sharpened their tongues like a sword, they aimed bitter speech as their arrow to shoot from concealment at the blameless. That's what they did with the men of Shechem. Suddenly they shoot at him and do not fear. They hold fast to themselves an evil purpose. They talk of laying snares secretly. They say, who can see them? They devise injustices, saying, we're ready for a well-concealed plot. Which is exactly what Simeon and Levi did. For the inward thought and the heart of a man are deep. That's that go from concrete to abstract. It's not just that the Levites were murderers physically. They were murderers within, just like everybody else that they were sitting in with these cities, not only of the cities of refuge, but all the Levitical cities as well. And God scatters them and uses their rubble for building up of something that will be for the common good, which we talked a lot about last week. So they know who they are. They know they're murderers by choice. They also know who they are, that they're chosen priests. They chose murder, and God chose them as priests. They were there. They went first when they crossed the Jordan River. They went first in the midst of battles. They were always in the midst of battles. They were the one who gave the good word every battle. The Levites, the priests, the high priest, the priests, the Aaron's sons, and then the Levites were the ones who encouraged them. God is with you. They're the ones who brought the word as present with them in all those times. But they were able to do it only because they knew they were murderers and God chose them to do it, to go first. That God gave them that ability to say, I'm with you. I've chosen you as my own and I'm with you. Now you can go out and do this. In all of your vulnerability, in all the fact that everyone knows who you are, you're Aaron, you're Levi, this is who you are, you can do this because I am with you. I'm redeeming, I'm taking all the rubble of who you are, and you allowed that to be crashed down. Aaron allowed the humiliation and to say it was not, that wasn't a good way to live. Levi does the same thing. And God brings them to a place that they get to be used well for that. So they know not only that they're murderers and they're chosen priests, but they also know that they're called to be us role models. So it's not, well, that's who I was, so I don't ever want to talk about that again, and this is who God's made me. It's, I'm both, and I continue to struggle. There will continue to be cycles of battles and living safely. I'm going to continue to be this. You're going to continue to be this. We're all living amongst each other. So that those cities of refuge were great models for the Levites themselves, where they lived among. They didn't separate themselves. They knew that the us model meant that they had to be connected to people. They couldn't be off at the temple. Of course, we see this corrupted, right, until we get into the New Testament and we see, oh my goodness, the Levites are so separate from people that they even have now a new sect, the Pharisees, and they get even more separate from people. The Levites' model was that they lived amongst people. So we have 48 cities all over the place. They are never together. They don't congregate in Levite places, and they don't just use Levite things, and they don't just listen to Levite music, and they don't just... It's not this nice clothes, oh, we're Levites. We're Levites, and we gotta be away from everybody. God purposely scatters them everywhere. And they don't have little Levite congregations everywhere. They have to live amongst everybody. As us. If they aren't living amongst as us, they can't minister as priests, right? Because priests are saying, hey, we're in Trinitarian relationship. We're all us. You cannot minister if you're always here and you got these walls and you're a Levite, so you only do Levite things and you only do it with Levite people. Well, how in the world do you minister then? You minister as charity. You go from your high Levite place to that lowly place of you pagans over there, you non-Levites there. God didn't choose you, but you know what? Maybe I'll bring God to you. Do you see that? You see what's happening with Levi? This is an amazing thing that's happening with Levi, with the tribe of Levi. This is why the Levites are going, hey, give us our possession. We want to go be scattered. We don't want to remain here. That's not life. God knows exactly what life is. Not just for us, but for all, because Trinitarian relationship is really what life is all about.
Well, I'm thinking, too, about, like, as history progresses, so you have the Levites invited to do this, then you have the cities of refuge, like, no one's really coming, and what happens, like, they need to feel useful, right? Yep. Like, I need to be seen here as more than just someone who's
right
living off the
right,
land.
Right.
And so they start, like, well, we'll just start, you know, reviewing the laws, and actually now we're going to start making laws, and now we're going to have more laws, and then I'm going to teach you about the laws. Like, it was almost like what once you get to Jesus' time, mm-hmm, with Pharisees and Sadducees, that was the sense. And then we're like, well, let's hang out with the other people who are making laws. Like, it becomes this thing where in our, like, need to feel valuable, we create something that God had already created for us,
right,
to do, and we don't rest in it.
Right. Right,
you
exactly,
know?
Exactly.
So, like I said, like now, so we're, yep, now, we've got a lot of purpose.
Yeah,
in our
exactly,
churches,
exactly,
you know?
Right.
Wait,
right.
Our purpose was to,
yeah,
be, you know.
Yes, exactly. So the model of us is exactly what the Levites are supposed to be doing, which is, I mean, all you have to think about the fact that the Levites get scattered all over as a model of us, not as a model of us and them, as a model of humility. We're going to accept this as life because God knows best. They do. They are actually supposed to be teachers, but teachers as us. Oh, this is how they are actually the ones who know God's word and are supposed to dispense them as us. There's a difference between dispensing God's words as us and them, and dispensing them as us. Would you agree?
Oh yeah.
Yeah. Have you ever sat under anyone who's teaching you as if they got it all right? I had a teacher who did that, who I knew was going through awful things and never would say, I failed here. I don't know what to do here. And I'm like, well, what do you have to teach me? Because I can never get as high as you. I can never be that perfect. That should never be. A Levite, a priest, should never purposely make feel someone that they can't get there. which is actually the purpose why I've had people teaching you to show all of you can do this. It's just basically time, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, and I, on that note, I meant to tell you guys, I think sometimes because I'm such a loudmouth, like people are like, oh, it's so easy for her to talk. Like, I was like so nervous. I was totally nervous, and I was like getting hot, like my heart was racing. But anyway, I only say that because like I'm you too, and I feel like anyone could do this, and it's not like somebody is, you know, good at it or should be more. You know what I'm saying?
Yep.
It's like I just want you guys to know I'm like I'm us when I did this because I was like freaking out. I was freaking out.
I do too. And I told you that before, but it's not like it just comes naturally. It's easier because I've practiced, but definitely not any easier than it would be for anybody else. All that to say, they are teachers, and they are the judges. And by judges, I mean they use their words to help people make decisions. You know, I don't know what to do here, and they help. And they help by the Levites are the one who bring God's word in the present. They say, it wasn't God said then, it's they encompass the present. And they do that by the fact that they are Levites in the midst of all of them, that they are actually encompassing, taking God as their possession. And so that is how they become the judges and the protectors, in the sense that they try to keep them whole and pure, as far as your wholeness is found in your vulnerability and your connection with God. Your wholeness is found in the fact that God wants you to be whole and take more and more of your possession up from the rubble, not from things you can do. Beside the fact that they are trying to keep humility alive, they're also, their job is to keep dependability alive, dependence alive. And this is, I think, probably the hardest thing for us. I think even harder than humility many times is they're scattered without any resources. They have the pasture land to raise their cows, and the cows aren't for them. The cows are to go back to Shiloh and eventually Jerusalem. They are there at the mercy of the people in the town. It's not all Levites. It's whatever tribe they're in. And they're there at the mercy. Their dependence comes from the people giving them their living, giving a tithe. First fruits. They're supposed to give to the Levites. And then the Levites aren't just takers, they give theirs to Aaron and his family, a first fruit of theirs. They are living with, completely dependent on what the people are giving them. They're not demanding it. This is what they're supposed to be doing, but they have to go, well, I'm trusting that all the people are going to actually raise us up, are actually going to be priests to us. So you see, all of a sudden, it's not just them being priests to them. It's the other people being priests to them, to the tribal people, or to the people of the tribe, them also being priests to the Levites, that they'll lift them up. That's how a priest was supposed to live. They were supposed to be supported, wholly dependent on the people.
Well, I mean, we were talking about this the other day. A kind of good modern-day model of this is actually, like, in the Catholic Church, these, you know, rectories, these parsonages. You know, some other churches have these parsonages that are set up for the priests, you know what I mean, or the pastors. That was bought by the community for them to be able to serve. And somebody was telling me yesterday about this show, Pastors of L.A. Have you guys heard of this? Heard of this reality TV show? I guess it's like crazy. These pastors are crazy and they're millionaires and driving Bentleys and all these things. Well, I mean, that was because they kind of felt like, I'm going to get life for myself. Why can't I live like everybody else? I'm in L.A. I should be able to get life for myself. And I said to one of my friends who was a pastor, I was like, you know, that's what you get when you forget this picture of dependence on each other. Do you know what I mean? When you forget, like, that parsonage is a good thing, you know?
Right.
And he said, well, I don't like the idea of parsonage at all because I don't have any equity. And so it was like we are uncomfortable with this picture of dependence, and yet it's the model God set out for us.
Right, totally. So the fact that the Levites are completely dependent is a show of us, is a model of us. And if you've ever been in that place where you're completely dependent, The thing is, you also have to let God get rid of that fact where you have a right for them to. Mm-hmm. So, you know, I can say to you, you know, guys, why aren't you paying me? Mm-hmm. You know, why aren't you bringing me gifts all the time? I mean, I can have that attitude, right? I don't have, as a priest, I go first. I give to you. And let God allow you to bring whatever it is that is making a mutual dependence. It's not a transaction. I can't make it a transaction. You can't make it a transaction. It's got to be this mutual, we live as us. You need things. I need things. Whatever it is, I want to be able to be living in that. And the priests go first by doing that, whether or not they get the tithe or not. And here's my most, well, not, it's not even a guess. I know, because you go into Micah and we realize that the people aren't giving to the priests, and the priests, the Levites aren't giving to the priests. And they're actually building their own homes. Mm-hmm. So we see this happening when we aren't resting in what God provides in a model of us.
But the priests aren't just first in service. They're also first in saying what they need.
Yes, exactly.
You know
exactly.
What I mean?
Yes.
And that's kind
yep.
of like,
yep.
you don't say what you need, it's
right.
really hard to even, you know.
Right, right, exactly. So we have them giving to the congregation as the congregation is giving to them. We have them living among, not in just these little Levite conclaves. I think that's a huge deal when we see the Levites scattered, is they're not just congregating and it's all about the Levites. They can't even do that. Like, they live in all sorts of different cities. They can't have their own little tribe and be separate. Mm-hmm. But they also assure unity of the whole, mm-hmm. because they are on a rotating basis, is where they actually have to go into Shiloh, later Jerusalem, on a rotating basis. We see this with a lot of the Hannah's, not Hannah's. John the Baptist's father has to go. Why can't I think of his name right now? Who's the baptist? Who?
Zechariah.
Yeah. Zechariah goes to the temple, right? Right. He has to go there because that's his rotating schedule as a Levite. Mm-hmm. He goes there and they serve there and he comes back. And so what you have is, all of the tribes have a centralized area to go to say, hey, we're all one. We're all connected because of being connected to God. Mm-hmm. And then they bring back that connection. And so the Levites are also responsible to keep unity within the whole of Israel because of who they are, us, and they keep connected. They keep connected with the people. They keep connected with God. And so they keep this Trinitarian relationship going.
And then, I mean, essentially Jesus then does that too.
Correct.
I mean, he scatters his disciples. He scatters them all over
yep.
the place. And he forces them, in a way, into dependence by not taking anything with them.
Right, mm-hmm. right, exactly. So that's kind of the whole picture of the Levites. So in doing that, in my priestly service, you know, you have to ask yourself a question. Is your service on a charity level? If it is, it's not a model of us. You're not doing a priestly service then. Mm-hmm. Then you're doing, a charity. Is your priestly service in mutual dependence, or is it, I don't need to rely on others. I don't need to tell them my needs. I don't need anything from them. I just need to give. This is my gift, and I just need to give. Well, no, actually, that's only half of it, and that's not the priestly service. Is your priestly service living amongst, or are you separated? I'm sorry, but the other day I looked, there was an ad for a Christian bookstore, and it had a coupon, 20% off of any Christian item. I just wanted to throw the magazine at the wall. What is a Christian item? Really? Really, guys? A Christian item? What is a Christian item? Doesn't make any sense. I've just put a verse on it, so now it's a Christian item. The Levites don't live like that. There isn't a Levite mug. There isn't a Levite dish.
I bet there was. They came up with it.
Maybe eventually, but that wasn't God's plan, right? It was never God's plan to have any kind of a Levite item that you could sell in a transaction. All of that just... Man, lots of bubbled up from that. Mm-hmm. But if you're not living amongst, you're not doing priestly service.
And seeing yourself as a manslayer.
If you don't see yourself as a manslayer, you're not doing priestly service. If you think, I've got it all together, well, I don't think any of us think we have it all together, do we?
I only do when I look at...
Who's worse than you?
Worse,
yes, yes.
Like, oh, I do have it all together.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Yes.
I would say this to Judge.
Yes.
The thing I get most mad at my husband about is the one thing he's worse at me at. Do you know what I mean?
Yes.
Like, I don't look at all the things he's great at.
Yep.
I decide to pick the one thing he's worse at.
Yep.
And then I feel better.
Yeah. And lastly, think about this. If your priestly service isn't built from the rubble of your life, from the rubble of the walls God's taken down, then it's still a Jericho wall, and you're not able to minister in an us model.
Mm-hmm.
It's got to be from the rubble. It cannot be from the walls you've built.
Mm-hmm.
From the things you've built in your independence, it's got to come from the rubble of that. So all of that, which seemed like such a short lesson, so much more. Father, we thank you and praise you that you are a God who redeems all those stupid walls we keep building and that we keep trying to re-erect. You redeem those, and you give us the rubble, and you roll it and make it alive, and you say, here, live here in the rubble where I am making a place that's safe and open and free for anyone to come with roads double wide, with a sign that says, here's grace. Thank you that you had that for us. We pray that we would have that for others in your power and coming from Shiloh. In Jesus' name, amen.
Amen.